The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 22nd of July 2021 on Monocle 24.
The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards.
And I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's program.
We have to get to the bottom of what happened. That's the only way we're going to be able to prevent the next pandemic, or at least do a better job in mitigating it.
The U.S. Foreign Policy Chief, Antony Blinken, continues to push China over the origins of COVID-19. But has Beijing effectively ceased all cooperation?
Plus, we'll have the latest from Tokyo as the director of the Olympics opening ceremony is forced to quit a day before the showpiece begins.
We'll also be rounding up the day's business headlines, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco brings us his weekly pop extravaganza. What have you got for us, Faye?
Chris, today we're going truly global. I'll share the delightful songs that are making the world dance.
Thanks very much, Fernando. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak.
And me, Tom Edwards.
China's health ministry has rejected the second phase of the World Health Organization's plan to investigate the origins of COVID-19. The WHO wants to look more closely at whether the virus could have actually escaped from a Chinese laboratory. But Beijing's leadership has flatly refused to play ball and says the probe, quote-unquote, defies science. Now, we heard from Antony Blinken at the top of the show. This is what the World Health Organization's Director General, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, had to say.
We are asking, actually, China to be transparent, open, and cooperate, especially on the information raw data that we asked for at the early days of the pandemic.
That was the head of the World Health Organization. Let's now get the latest on this with Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith. Chris is also a consultant virologist at Cambridge University. Chris, thanks for joining us on the show today. Let's start with what the WHO found out in the first phase, if you will, of its investigation and what it really hopes to find out this time.
Well, I think they found out that although China paid them a whole heap of money, they're not very cooperative because it took them a very long time. In fact, it was a year before boots hit the ground in China, in Wuhan, in order to start an investigation. And when they did that investigation, it was dubbed by many as just a stage-managed puppet show. And they spent a very short amount of time in any of the venues which are implicated in the outbreak. And they spent even less time actually getting the samples that they asked for. In fact, they hit a brick wall. And so as a result of that, people have decried this as just sort of lip service and asked for a more formal investigation. The WHO are now saying, well, we'd like to make a few more inquiries. And China, as you've just said, are flatly refusing to cooperate.
Well, I suppose the question then is, what was the WHO expecting would be one thing. Were they hoping for any form of cooperation on this? As you say, the last time round, it took a year. There wasn't much cooperation when it started. Did they really expect a second phase to actually yield results?
Well, I think China are recognising that the world is staring at them and that the world wants answers. And if China has nothing to hide, as they say they don't have anything to hide, then why are they not being open and transparent and cooperating more effectively, more consistently and more rapidly? A year, as some people put it, between actually an outbreak occurring and then people being allowed access to Ground Zero is more than enough time to clean up any kind of mess and bury quite a few skeletons that were lurking in closets, and I strongly suspect that that has been going on. I think the WHO had expected probably better treatment. They've been very, very gracious towards China, but they're paid a lot of money by China, and that's part of the reason why Donald Trump got the ump with the WHO and withdrew American support, because he recognised that there was evidence of conflict of interest. But the WHO are really being made out to look like fools, because China is basically just saying, no, we're not interested in playing ball with you.
Well, given that side of the WHO, the funding that they get from China, as you say, what do you think they should do differently? What can they do differently? What pressure can they bring to bear on China? And you know, how far could the WHO, can they do anything really on their own?
I don't think they can. They are a global organisation that people involve in situations like the one we're currently in. But they can't predate the situation. They're not a predator that will have China running scared. China will just say, no thanks. And the only thing that really will, I think, work here is massive concerted international pressure. China's got most of the world addicted to its mass manufacturing, and we're all buying stuff from China. And you just have to look at what happened when the Suez Canal was blocked by the boat Evergreen over the previous few months. The supply chains from China were interrupted temporarily, and it had an immediate knock-on effect. There were repercussions. I think if the world starts to say, well, hang on a minute, you know, this has impacted everybody, this is not a finger-pointing exercise, this is a learning exercise, and it's in everybody's interest that we all get together, we work together, and we work out how these sorts of things happen and put in place some kind of safeguards and surveillance system so that there is openness and transparency and data sharing with everybody everywhere. That's in China's interest as well as everyone else's interest. And I think the way that to bring China to the table and make them listen is to say, we're going to stop buying your rubbish and just stop buying cheap Chinese toot, and just and start. The only thing they'll listen to is cash. That's all they're interested in. So I think that the world has to make a united, concerted effort and basically cut off the nourishing supply of cash flowing Beijing's way, which will, I think, have an influence.
Well, just at the end to play, in a way, devil's advocate, I suppose, and turn it around. The rhetoric from China on these things is always, you know, quite fascinating. The way that they speak about it, that they made this comment that the investigation, you know, disregards common sense and defies science. Is that purely just deflection and propaganda, or is there any truth to it at all?
Well, if you're asking a question, science is all about questions. It's not about answers. Science is about coming up with a hypothesis and then testing it. And you find out whether your hypothesis is right or wrong, and you refine it accordingly. There's unanswered questions here, and there are some very simple experiments scientifically that could be done to see whether or not we can probe the origins of COVID within China. That simple question would be, can we please have samples of sewage water, blood, and other specimens that are routinely kept for public health and medical and diagnostic reasons in laboratories and hospitals all over the world? We know China's got them in spades. We have them in all of our countries. Can we please have those? Because if there's nothing to hide here, if there's nothing to see here, we can just sample some of those. We don't even have to have the details of the people. We just have anonymous blood samples. We just read what's in there and we'll find out where COVID came from. And China are flatly refusing. Now, if there's nothing to hide and there's nothing to see here, I don't see why they're refusing to do that. We could do the experiments in China that are currently being repeated in Italy. You'll have seen the data this week where the researchers who initially published some preliminary data about a year ago now, saying we've got evidence that there was already SARS-CoV-2, the cause of COVID, circulating in parts of Italy in October 2019. And people said, well, it might be spurious, might not be quite reliable. They've been back and repeated these studies, and there are people who are in various studies and cancer treatment trials that have antibodies to this virus at that time. And the only place they would have got those antibodies is if they've been infected with it. So that suggests it was already circulating in India. If we could repeat that experiment in China, and do this geographically, we have a chance perhaps of piecing back together whether there was a trail into the country from a rural area, which is what we are being told is the most likely source of emergence. We'll be able to track that. We can see how the virus perhaps got across the country and date by date, and that gives us a clearer picture. Why China won't volunteer these services, I don't know. Their excuse is that this has privacy issues for the patients whose samples might be analysed. But, I mean, that's just bunkum. This is coming from the country that has the worst track record on human rights, civil liberties and monitoring of its populace of any country in the world.
Well, that's a sad place to leave it, but we're going to leave it there, Chris. Thanks very much for joining us. That was Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith. Now, here's Emma Searle with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Chris. The United States says it has reached a deal with Germany to prevent Russia from using its Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline as political leverage over Europe. The pipeline, which is nearing completion, stretches 1,200 kilometers under the Baltic Sea and will double Russian gas exports to Germany. Four members of the now-defunct Apple Daily newspaper have appeared in a Hong Kong court to face charges of colluding with foreign forces. The tabloid, which was owned by the pro-democracy media tycoon Jimmy Lai, folded last month following continued harassment from officials. The director of the Olympics opening ceremony has been dismissed just a day before the showpiece is due to be held. Footage of Kentaro Kobayashi from the 1990s recently emerged, in which he appears to be making jokes about the Holocaust. We'll have more on the story shortly. And the Piccadilly Art Takeover opens its doors today, transforming original artworks into 30 hanging panels and 13 painted murals on pedestrian crossings across London. Find out more about the project by heading to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Tom and Chris, over to you.
Thanks, Emma. Now, when it rains, it pours. The creative show director of the Olympics opening ceremony has been let go just one day before the event is due to be held. It comes after footage of Kentaro Kobayashi from the 1990s revealed that the former comedian made inappropriate jokes about the Holocaust. The dismissal is the latest in a long line of scandals to hit the Games. Let's get the latest now on this with Monocle's Tokyo bureau chief and Asia editor, Fiona Wilson. Good evening, Fiona. This is really such depressing news. The organization of this has been quite a shambles, and especially, you know, at a time when the focus should really be on the athletes and the joys of participating in an opening ceremony. They just can't catch a break, can they?
No. Hi, Chris. You're absolutely right. We've pretty much forgotten about the athletes, haven't we? I just feel, you know, the last few days, the opening ceremony particularly, it's just been sort of engulfed in scandal after scandal. This is the latest. I mean, it just sort of came out of nowhere, this one. Kentaro Kobayashi, who was a very popular comedian and back in the late 90s, he did this really unfortunate skit where he sort of parodied an educational program on Japanese TV by making a joke about let's pretend to do the Holocaust. Sort of unthinkable, obviously. The Simon Wiesenthal Center pointed that out pretty quickly. And, you know, actually, they didn't hesitate. Some of these scandals in the past, they've waited just too long. They've said he's apologized and they've waited. And then public outcry becomes too loud and they can't ignore it. This time, they dealt with it very quickly. And Seiko Hashimoto, who's the, you know, the head of the 2020 Olympics, president of the Olympics, said, you know, we're still considering our options. So who knows what tomorrow's ceremony is going to look like? We've had a little sneak preview of some drone light shows. But at the moment, yeah, it's anyone's guess, really.
And it sounds like you likely won't be there to watch for yourself, Fiona. Very restricted on numbers, of course, the opening ceremony. I think only about 1,000, you've mentioned before. To Chris's point, though, about, you know, we should be talking about the athletes. In Olympics gone by, you could wander through the mix zone, maybe have a chat to a few people. That's not even there. Do we even know how the athletes are feeling? I imagine their mood must be similarly somber.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, you know, social media obviously allows people to express fairly directly how they're feeling. But you're absolutely right. I mean, tomorrow's opening ceremony, which should be this sort of stadium packed event. Yeah, there are going to be 1,000 people, just 150 Japanese, I have to say, 800 visiting VIPs. You know, the emperor will be there, not the empress. We know the head of Toyota won't be there. And nor will Shinzo Abe, the prime minister who actually secured the game. So, you know, I think it's going to be pretty subdued. And they've been using words like it will be a sobering ceremony, which doesn't exactly sound thrilling. But yeah, I mean, you know, obviously everyone wants to get onto the sport. We've seen some pretty amazing images coming out of, there was a fantastic photo from Canadian sailing team today. They were out practicing with this incredible view of Mount Fuji behind them. And, you know, a reminder that other things are going on and everyone's just hoping that they can just get over this opening ceremony and just get the events actually started in earnest. You know, we might stop talking about all this stuff around it.
Well, Fiona, on that point, some of the events, you know, have actually already started, which, as you say, it's hard to almost focus on because there's been so much else happening. But are there any highlights for you so far? Is there some anticipation building? I know the Japanese softball team won, for example, their first event.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that was exciting. I mean, you know, that's a great start for Japan. You know, they've got big expectations and there are a lot of medal hopefuls in Japan. You know, you've got loads of people, martial arts, you know, because you're seeing karate for the first time. You've got many hopefuls in judo. I mean, Japan absolutely dominated the 2019 World Championships. They're very hopeful there. I'm excited to see the surfing. Kanoa Igarashi, big Japan hopeful there. That's another first. So that will be exciting. You've got swimming kicking off. Medals competitions will start, you know, the swimming will start Saturday, but the medals will begin on Sunday. So they're going to have several days. That will be exciting. The pool looks absolutely amazing so far. So, you know, hopefully I will be able to get and see some events. Just wait and see what those will be at the moment. But no, there's lots of excitement around the event, the actual sport. I just think there's so much else going on that it's been very, very difficult to feel much celebration at the moment.
Well, yeah, Fiona, and just on that final point, you think back to previous Olympic Games where, you know, there were question marks about the public attitude for one reason or another, admittedly not the backdrop of a pandemic, you know, in London 2012. And then you had this sort of Super Saturday where all the Brits won and everyone forgot about the previous. The Sydney Games way back in 2000 was the same. And then everyone remembers now Kathy Freeman winning. Do you think that maybe a Japanese athlete in one of these disciplines could be the only image that comes to mind in years to come if they win big, you know, well enough? Or is this going to always be, you know, the delayed pandemic games?
Yeah, I mean, that wouldn't that be brilliant if there were some highlights like that? I think at the moment, you know, obviously headline news today is that a 6-month high in COVID infection numbers in Japan, you know, so that's really sort of hogging the headlines. You know, it's going to be difficult for Japan to see it as a success. I mean, what they're hoping for is, please just, can we not have a Tokyo Olympics variant of the virus or an absolute explosion in case numbers? That would be a success. I think, you know, it would be thrilling if some Japanese athletes did well, and if any athlete does well, you know, if any records are broken, it would be absolutely brilliant. I don't think it will obliterate this whole run up to the Olympics. It's just been too damaging, I think. And you see it, Neela, in Tokyo. I wouldn't say there's a hostility to the game so much as a kind of indifference, which is a bit sad. And in many ways, you can carry on life barely noticing the Olympics are going on. So I think once the TV footage pops up on our screens and we really feel it's happening. At the moment, it's almost like it's sort of happening somewhere. We're just not connected to it.
Fiona, always good to hear from you. And we'll be hearing plenty more from Fiona in the days ahead and from our Kieran Pender, who's actually on the other side within the reporting bubble of the Games across Monocle 24. You're listening to The Briefing.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. A global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, I'm two Novartis leaders from Data42, Novartis's digital research and development platform. In short, the goal of Data42 is to capture the hidden insights from the massive amount of research and clinical trial data of Novartis and to tap into a powerful technological trend. Achim Plückebaum heads up Data42 and Gabriel Eichler is head of data at Data42. Data42 is driven by both global drug development and the Novartis Institute for Biomedical Research, which are run by John Tsai and Jay Bradner, from whom we've heard before. Achim, Gabriel, welcome. So what was the idea behind Data42, the origin story, if you like, of this whole project? We've heard in previous episodes about the role that Douglas Adams' famous tale, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, played. Achim, what is this story?
The purpose of Data 42 is actually quite simply explained. We have generated over decades and decades a lot of data in our R&D environment. And very often these data sets have been utilized for very specific purposes. Usually it was used to either find a new compound or to bring it into our clinical trials and eventually to bring our drugs to the regulators to get approval so that we can market our drugs. But the problem with all of these data sets is that they are disconnected. They usually look at this very, very specific purpose only, but they never look at some linkages between the different data sets and also the ability to potentially look a bit further above and beyond what this primary data set was all about. So our idea was very simple. What if all of these data sets can be combined together? And what if our researchers and developers, of which we have in Novartis alone, roughly 20,000 people, what if we could give them this treasure of data all together, but not just as a data dump, as we would say, but in a clean and curated fashion, and all linked together. So if you have one question on a cardiovascular disease, you can not just look in cardiovascular data, you can look in all the data of all the disease areas of all the time we have ever generated, all cleanly linked and nicely prepared, so to say, so that our researchers can do their work. That's what is behind. And yes, it is based on The Hitchhiker's Guide of the Galaxy, because the problem is when you get such a rich set of data, you need to ask the right question. Otherwise, you get lost. And otherwise, you wait a million years, like in the Deep Thought computer in the famous science fiction book, and you just get a garbage answer. So we are very keen on not only providing clean data, but we are also very keen on working with our scientists to make sure that they ask the right questions to this rich data set.
Achim Plückebaum, head of Data 42. An enduring commitment for more than a quarter of a century. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You're back with The Briefing on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Chris Chermak in the chairs today. Let's get a business update now with Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Thanks for joining us as always, Ewan, and a very good afternoon to you. More warnings about rising prices first up.
Tom, yeah, rising inflation is perhaps the hottest topic of the moment amongst economists and investors around the world. There's absolutely no doubt the prices are rising right across the world and in many, many sectors. The discussion is really whether that will be transitory or whether it will stick. A couple of indicators for you today. Arabica coffee prices have surged to their highest level in 6 years, driven by increasing supply and signs of shrinking global supplies. A drought had already slashed yields for the current crop of coffee beans, but now two frosts in less than a month in Brazil, the world's top exporter, clipping prospects for output in the following season. And of course, rebounding demand is compounding the crisis, as in many, many markets. Inventories in consuming countries like the US are shrinking as cafes reopen as restrictions are eased. And a warning from Unilever, the consumer goods giant, as well today, that raw materials that go into shampoo, detergents and many of its food products, including ice cream, are rising at the fastest pace in more than a decade. Unilever is contending with more expensive crude oil, palm oil and freight costs, amongst other things. It is increasing prices, but not as quickly as its costs are going up. So that is squeezing margins at Unilever.
Ewan, it's Chris here. We're, I'm sure, going to be following this price debate for many months and weeks and months ahead. But one other story for you. Face-to-face talks have also been agreed between China and the US.
Yeah, Chris, it's the latest effort by both sides to keep a growing list of disputes from spiraling out of control. Representatives from the world's two biggest economies are to meet next week. Deputy US Secretary of State Wendy Sherman is to meet with Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi. The FT has been reporting that there's a lot of behind-the-scenes wrangling. Apparently, the American diplomat had suspended her plans after being offered only a meeting with one of Wang's subordinates. It was perhaps the last chance before October, when there's a G20 summit, for the two sides to stabilize their relations somewhat. That's the most likely opportunity for President Biden to meet China's Xi Jinping for the first time. We've been hearing, of course, over recent weeks about a growing list of tensions between the two powers. President Biden has been building what you might call perhaps a democratic united front to counter Beijing. And he's also kept many of President Trump's more confrontational policies in dealing with China. So let's see if next week yields any warming of relations. Probably best not to hold your breath too much.
Ewan, thank you very much. That was Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally, on today's program, we are joined by Monocle's senior correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, for this week's pop extravaganza, The Global Countdown. Faye, you have something a little special for us today?
Very special this week, Chris. And first of all, welcome to the Global Countdown. Very exciting.
Thank you. I am excited.
Yeah. I mean, of course, it's the Olympics. And I thought about, should I do the top five songs in Japan? But I've done this quite recently, actually. So, in fact, there is a global chart with the top five songs worldwide. So I decided to do that. I mean, so this is kind of the Olympics of music, if you know what I mean.
And that's there's something, a good point.
There's something very special here. Every single one of the artists, they come from a different country. There's no repetition. It was almost accidental, actually. So shall we give the medals then?
I mean, that makes absolute sense. You have to go for five different countries, though, to be fair.
Like,
that was the best way to do it. But let's start up at number five.
Number five is a very curious story. It's Maneskin, the Italian band that won Eurovision this year. I mean, massive successful story. But they are number five with a different song. They're not with Zitti Buoni. They are with a song called Begging. It's a cover for the classic for the Four Seasons. And this song was in their album from 2017. And you know why it resurfaced in the charts? Because of TikTok. You know, people started and everybody's sharing. And the song became a big hit. Shall we have a listen? Not everyone liked this version, by the way. But I want to hear your opinion after. Let's have a listen.
Zambe.
Do you like it? I gotta say, I find it fascinating how everyone is like pouring over Maneskin since the Eurovision victory. I'm not sure that's their best, to be honest. Also, the fact that you even just pick a cover to go with from everything that they've done and go back to 2017, it's a little strange.
It's a little strange, but all I can say, they are becoming proper rock stars. I mean, there were stories in the Brazilian press about that, and here they are in the charts. I mean, because to be honest, in the last 10 years, the Eurovision winners, they were not really kind of dominating the charts worldwide. But I think there's an appetite for rock. We discussed this, Tom, a few weeks ago. I think rock music's kind of back in a different form, perhaps.
I was going to say, thanks for the caveat. That's not rock as I see it. I feel there's something vaguely criminal about butchering, like Begging, a classic track. That version, I'm not that into it.
But shall we continue with the rocky vibe? Again, I think Tom might be a little bit angry with me, but
get the sense that another rock tune is coming up. Here.
Exactly. A little bit pop rock. Let's have a listen, and I want to talk a bit more about her. It's Olivia Rodrigo, Good For You, number four.
Like it's a therapist I found for you. She really helped. Now you can be a better man for your brand new girl.
I'm charmed by Rodrigo, actually.
I mean, it's catchy. I'm not sure in my mind that it's that unique in its style compared to many things we've heard before.
Chris. It doesn't mean it's a good thing. Where's she hail from, Fernando?
She's from the US, United States, the only American artist. And she's doing a great job as well. She met President Biden recently, to invite young people to be vaccinated. She's incredibly influential. Her album is the number one in the albums chart. Some people say that she will win all the Grammys next year as well. So yeah, good on Olivia Rodrigo.
That had a kind of late 90s vibe to it.
Yeah, yes.
Kind of feeling that?
Avril Lavigne, kind of that kind of pop punk vibe. Avril Lavigne, yeah. I was there at that time.
Just about. I wonder, it's the kind of Olympic Games equivalent.
Yes.
Should we move to the podium positions and who's in bronze?
You know who is bronze? The UK. The United Kingdom. Of course, the United Kingdom had to be there. And again, guy, in the past, I was not a big fan of this artist. I've changed my mind. I like it. He knows how to create a big earworm, right? That's how you say. It's Ed Sheeran with the lovely electropop beat of Bad Habits. Clothes.
To late nights sitting alone, conversations with a stranger I barely know, swearing this will be the last, but it probably won't. I got nothing left to lose or use.
I have to say I'm enjoying the scrunchy faces of our producer in the background.
tell me, because Ed Sheeran, you know, he doesn't have the quintessential classic pop star looks, vibes. He doesn't necessarily hail from one of the kind of epicenters even here in the UK. This guy's cracked the global market every single time. What is the secret to his kind of seemingly implausible success?
You know what? He's a very intelligent man. He writes amazing songs, not only for him. I mean, I'll tell you a bit more about that. You know, there's a surprise here on the Global Countdown. And again, with that song, perhaps it's not the most original one. It's almost a copy of what The Weeknd has been doing for a bit now. But I mean, it works. I mean, it's number three here. And he's kind of stylish as well more recently. In the video for that song, he's wearing a pink suit, which is very much on trend. Spike Lee at Cannes Film Festival wearing an amazing Louis Vuitton one. I wonder if he's wearing a Louis Vuitton or not. I should do a better research next time.
Well, let's move swiftly on to the silver medal position. We're getting close now.
We have to divide, actually, the silver, because there are two artists. One is from Australia and the other one is from Canada. Again, a combination of two massive pop stars these days. Let's have a listen to the songs by The Kid LAROI from Australia and Justin Bieber from Canada with Stay. It's so catchy, right?
We're getting increasingly poppy, I sense, as we get to the sort of gold medal positions.
Oh, God, wait until you see the gold. But The Kid LAROI is such a good story as well. He's only 17. He's an indigenous Australian, but now I think he lives in LA. He's doing so well everywhere. And of course, Justin Bieber noticed that and invited him for a song, of course. I mean, makes sense.
Interesting stuff, Fernando. Do we continue in this increasing poppiness? When we get to the top of the pile, it's the global countdown. Number one, gold medal position. Who is atop the podium?
I mean, of course they would be here. They're juggernauts there. It's BTS with their new song. Everything that BTS releases, I mean, it will be number one. But before we hear that, guys, do you know who actually co-wrote that song?
Can I take a wild guess?
Yes.
Is it Ed Sheeran?
Yes. It is. That's what I'm telling you.
I was going to say Justin Bieber, maybe. Exactly. Sorry if I fit his way
the Kid
in,
LAROI.
But sure.
I mean, but BTS is amazing. He even was invited by the South Korean president to be a special kind of envoy for the country. And they will be at the UN General Assembly in September as well. They will be representing South Korea. So they are huge. I mean, BTS, it's undeniable. I'm not even sure if it's about K-pop. I think it's generally about BTS and their power. The song is called, I mean, I said that we were going to make the world dance. It's called Permission to Dance.
Just dream about that moment when you look yourself right in the eye. Then you say, I want to dance. The music's got me going and nothing I can stop how we move. Yeah, let's make a place and live just like we're golden and rolling like we're dancing for.
Well done, BTS and South Korea. They get the gold medal. I mean, it's undeniable. Although the UK, you know, might get a special prize here because of Ed Sheeran.
Honourable mention.
Exactly.
No one really cares about the trainer behind the athlete, though, do they?
That's true.
What did you think, Fernando? You made a slightly wrinkly face during that one.
No, I mean, I like BTS.
Be honest.
Well, I prefer Butter, their previous song, as you know. But Permission to Dance, I think, is just nice. But I think, you know, we had amazing track by Olivia Rodrigo, the electropop of Ed Sheeran. But, you know, I'm not surprised that BTS is here. And well done for them. They're representing their country very well.
It's nice to hear you talk about their political engagement as well.
Course.
I feel like this entire countdown has had an Olympic and a political element to it throughout, which is very nice.
That's what we're in the business of doing that,
always.
Chris. We're the soft power experts, don't forget, Harry Monocle.
Thanks very much, Faye. That was Monocle 24's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James and Emma Searle and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our studio manager was Steph Chungu. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. That's midday London time. I'm Chris Chermak.
And I'm Tom Edwards. Goodbye, and thank you very much indeed for listening.